Bible reading so far takes us through Luke chapter 18 in the New Testament and 1 Samuel chapter 12 in the Old Testament. So we transition now into the book of Samuel. We touched on this a little bit last week, but just as a reminder, the book of Ruth takes place during the time of the Judges. And I like the way that the Word of God separates that out and gives it its own book, because it's kind of a refreshing break from the apostasy and homosexuality of Benjamin, and then the devastation that the tribe of Benjamin faces, and then the idiocy that the rest of the tribes come up with to find wives for Benjamin. And it's like, good grief, how much lower could you go? And then you turn the page and read the book of Ruth. And it's a wonderful reminder that even though there was all that foolishness going on in Israel and all the apostasy, there were still people who loved the Lord. There were still people who were faithful to the Lord during that period of time. And I think that's a great reminder for all of us. Always, God has preserved for himself a remnant. Every situation, I mean, even in the days of Noah, you read how bad it was, and yet here's Noah and his family. In Sodom, Lot was a righteous man, even though his family was not all around him. Abraham is faithful in the midst of the people that he lived in. And in Egypt, God had Moses. He had Moses' family. You know, it's just amazing to see. And so, you know, in a way, it's really sad when you see your country. You know, as the king goes, and we're going to get there, because now we're going to start talking about kings from this point in time on. But as the king goes, so goes the country. And that's just all there is to it. It's really, really sad, but it's the truth. But even in the midst of ungodly leaders, you still see godly families and godly people and prayerful people in the midst of those situations. And I think that's what Ruth is all about. So we transition in the book of Samuel. And I'd like to survey Samuel tonight. And I'd also like to do something else, but first, anybody got any questions they want to talk about? Something that you ran across as you were reading through from the book of Luke or the books of Ruth and Samuel? Everybody's up to date on their reading? Good. Have I run across anything that stumped you or found interesting or...
I just couldn't believe their problem, like their answer to the problem was like, we'll kidnap these people because we can't... I mean, kidnapping was their answer. This is like, how wrong can you go? Like, just blew my mind.
You know what?
We'll just tell them. It's okay. We'll just tell them that we couldn't give you our, you know, daughters for them to wed and that they can't.
Yeah, it's just probably the low point in the nation. You know, I mean, for one thing, you've got the apostasy that's taking place. Then you've got the homosexuality. It reminds you a lot. I mean, you can't help but read that story and it not remind you of the angels coming into Sodom to Lot's house. It's very, very similar. But unfortunately, that Levite and his concubine didn't have some angels to rescue him. And so they just threw her out in the street. Next morning, he's like, get up, let's go. You know, I mean, really, that is the way that story is portrayed. It's like, man, alive. And then the vengeance that is brought against the tribe of Benjamin is they almost completely wipe an entire tribe out. So yeah, it's a low point. And I can't help but think, as I think about the way they came up with, you know, we're going to have this party and all the virgins come out to dance. And if y'all were to sneak in there and steal one of them, well, we wouldn't do anything about it. Those girls, some of them probably have devoted themselves to the service of the tabernacle. And so that even makes that much more heinous of a situation. But here's what I see, Jennifer. I see a group of people who are making up their own rules, just like the rest of the book of Judges. There's no king in the land. People did whatever they wanted to. but they're playing at religion. So they're like, ooh, we made this vow, so let's find a loophole around the vow, you know? And I see, I mean, the Anglican Church exists today because of that very thing right there. The old king was ready to be done with his wife. He wanted to divorce her, trade her in for a newer model. And the Roman Catholic Church that was over him would not agree. You have to have an annulment. So you can't get a divorce. That's a no-no. But if the church annuls your marriage, that means it never existed in the first place. No. Which is just the biggest bunch. Anyway, so he appeals to the Pope. Pope says no, he won't grant the annulment. So he just excommunicates the church, starts his own church, sets himself as the head of it, divorces his wife, marries Anne, and ta-da, you got a whole new church. And I see it much the same way. They're apostate as they can be, and yet they're playing at religion. And so they make up a loophole to get around the vow that they made. It just shows you just how low the nation had gone at that point in time. So, yeah. Troublesome. Hard to read. Anybody else? Questions about this section?
So you were talking about Ruth, and it was a refreshing, in the midst of all that. If you really think about it, at the very end, the last, Ruth 4:22, her son is obviously really close to one. Like David's great-great-grandmother.
Right.
When you start reading it, you've got this young girl who took on a whole another world that she had nothing, no clue about, and we don't realize until she never realized until we know him that what part David plays in everything.
Sure.
When you get to Jesus, we talk about the line of David. Without her, we wouldn't have one.
Right.
You know, had she said, yeah, see, I'm going home to my family, we wouldn't have the line of David down to Jesus. It would have been a whole other story. So just having God, he orchestrates things that we don't really see until, oh, now I see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when it looks like all is lost, God's at work, you know? He's at work. He's thinking. You know, it's like a really good chess player. They're not just thinking about the next move. They're thinking like 10 moves in advance. And that's what God's doing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Ruth is a gem. It is this magnificent in the midst of all of that as you read through the judges. And then, you know, just immediately, then you read about little Samuel and what a great story. You know, by the way, what tribe is Samuel from? Winds up being a Levite, but he doesn't start out being a Levite, does he? No, he's from the tribe of Ephraim. His mother was married to Elkanah, and he's an Ephraimite. And so Samuel is one of those very few people who he winds up swapping tribes. And the reason is because instead of redeeming Samuel, like all Israelites were redeemed, Hannah promised, if God would allow her to have a child, that she would give him to the Lord. And so she literally gave her firstborn to become one of the Levites. And so Samuel is a transitionary guy. He and Eli. Eli is a judge and a priest. And so when Samuel comes along, Samuel's going to fulfill the role of judge and prophet and priest. And so he's the basically the last of the judges, and he's the king anointer. So he's gonna start the lineage of the king. So Samuel is a, you know, that if you had to sum up 1 Samuel with one word, it'd be transition, I think. Because this is a big time transition. We're going from no king, every man doing what he wants, what's his own thing, to a monarchy and a standardized way of doing things in Israel as far as the kingdom goes. So it's really interesting. Probably, I think there's probably, if we were to weigh like words on paper, there's as much about the life of David as there is about the life of Jesus. It's really interesting. I mean, there's an awful lot in the story of Samuel and into David. I mean, this is a huge time in the nation of Israel. It's a time of coming out of the apostasy of the judges and Samuel trying to point the people back toward the Lord and then transitioning into an unfaithful king and then to King David. So, real interesting time. Any other questions or thoughts before we... Yeah?
Quick question. I heard some preacher this week was talking about Boaz, and I thought he said his lineage was fascinating. I can't remember why. Do you know where Boaz, his line, where he... It was like, there was somebody that was...
Boaz and Ruth.
Well, no. He married Ruth, but he was from... Rahab or something. There was some interesting line there. Is he Rahab?
He's from Rahab. Yeah. A couple generations down.
I don't know that I've ever caught that before. Is it? And where is it? Matthew
1.
Luke.
Is it Luke?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm really paying attention as I read.
Huh? Yeah. Luke.
Which kind of goes along with what you're saying. God had it, all along the way.
Luke chapter 3, and so, okay, verse 32, son of Jesse, which is the son of Obed, which is the son of Boaz, which is the son of Salmon, which is the son of Nahshon, which is the son of Amminadab, which is the son of Aram, which is the son of Ezron, which is the son of Perez, which is the son of Judah. All the way back to Jacob. So traces his lineage there, and then in the book of Matthew, it traces his lineage.
I knew what came after Boaz. I just didn't. Okay.
Yeah, Matthew chapter 1. Aram beget Amminadab. Amminadab beget Nahshon. Nahshon beget Salmon. Salmon beget Boaz of Rahab. Boaz beget Obed. And Obed beget Jesse. So
that's Rahab. Okay.
Matthew 1:5.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, so that's how close we are to the conquest and there's several women who make the lineage of Jesus Christ.
Rahab was not known to be, well, she followed God. She had faith, but
once again, she's not an Israelite though.
And her right.
So Tamar, she is in the lineage of Christ, and she's basically has to disguise herself as a prostitute to get her father-in-law to raise up her son's child through Levirate marriage. Rahab to Boaz, Tamar, Rahab, who else?
Ruth,
Moabitess, and then and Solomon, and whatever her name is.
Bathsheba.
The wife of Uriah. Yeah. So all of those gals are listed in the lineage. No other women, too. No Israelite women, except Bathsheba and Tamar. Those, they're Israelites, but none of the other women are listed except Mary. But those women are listed. And I think it's cool how God does that, because it's like he's reminding us, hey, by the way, remember the story? Remember how this happened? All of these things, what we want is we want for everything for God to say, this is how you're going to do it, and we do it, and then he comes back. But that's not the case. It is this crazy, broken apostasy, curse this lineage, and pick up down here, and 100 years later, and curse this king, and kill off the entire the entire kingly line, and then find one over here that fits, and yeah, it's amazing. So I think it's that wonderful. I think it teaches us about God's grace. I think it is a reminder to the Hebrew not to be too proud, because the Messiah, the line of the Messiah, is not this straight, nice, clear-cut path that comes from all of these wonderful Israelites. There's some crazy things going on there. But yeah, that is right. So
first, after we talked, I got to looking at Ruth and Boaz being in the lineage anyway, because how it Obed should have gone over to Nahon's
right.
line and all that stuff, and just how, because I mean, otherwise you wouldn't have Rahab in there, you know, so it's amazing because you get all in that.
Right. Yeah, actually the baby should not be considered Boaz's, he should be considered Mahlon's son. Right? Because Boaz is performing the rite of kinsman redeemer, and that child is going to, but I think what happened is he keeps the name and the lineage, but the child gets all of Mahlon's inheritance, is probably the way that would work. But yeah, that is true. So, good point. Anybody else? Well, let's talk about 1 Samuel just a little bit. Let me give you a real quick outline. 1 Samuel really is about four people.
First of all, it's about a guy named Eli, who, by the way, is an interesting character to start with. Where does he come from? Second, it's about a guy named Samuel. Third, it's about a guy named Saul. And fourth, it's about a guy named David.
That's about as simple as you can get right there. Much like Genesis really is about a couple of events and then some people. Well, that's the way 1 Samuel is. The author is Samuel himself. So he writes this down, as well as Nathan and Gad. They play into this, those prophets. They 1 Chronicles 29:29 tells us that Nathan and Gad play into that. The time frame for this, of course, is one of those fun things, but I'm going to go with the range. I don't know exactly when Samuel was born, but I'm going to go with the range from 1169 to 1152 B.C. So somewhere in there Samuel is born, and it's a time of the Philistines really dominating Israel, and they're the ones that are the main protagonists during that period of time. Samuel certainly is a type of Christ in that he is a prophet, a priest, and a judge at the same time. And Christ, of course, fulfills the role of prophet, priest, and king. And then, of course, in the life of David, we see tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of types of the Lord Jesus Christ in the life of David. There's just so many of them that it would be hard to point them all out. So we see the whole thing start out with Samuel's call. Eli is a judge, and his time has come to an end. His sons are worthless. As you read about that, you see, of course, the lesson that always jumps out to me about Eli is a twofold lesson. Not only is he a spiritual leader for the nation, but he's also a father, and he's pretty much stinks in both of them. And he is held responsible by God because he knows what his sons are doing, but he does not put a stop to it. As the high priest, as well as their father, they didn't like the portion that the priest got, so they wanted other portions. They didn't want sodden meat. In other words, they didn't want their meat to be boiled. They wanted it roasted. They abused the women that came to the tabernacle. They were just worthless. The Bible calls them sons of Belial, and that is another way of saying sons of Satan, or the fact that they were lost. So here they are fulfilling priestly duties, working in the tabernacle, and they're lost. And pretty sad. Eli finds out that his sons have allowed the army to take the ark into battle. And you know, the Germans didn't have much luck with that. Indy knew better than to look in there. But where they got this idea that somehow they took the ark into battle, that God would not allow it to fall to uncircumcised hands, I suppose, is what they were thinking. They were thinking it was their magic totem that was going to give them victory. But, of course, the story is, of course, the other way around. They're both killed in battle. The ark is taken. The Philistines whip them and take the ark. And then, of course, the wonderful confrontation between the ark and Dagon, the god of the Philistines, is wonderful. Every time they set it in the temple, he knocks Dagon down, knocks his head off, knocks his hands off. So they send the ark back with some really interesting votive offerings made out of gold. Anybody know what emerods are? They were struck with
they had a mice infestation and emrods. Anybody know what that is?
Yeah,
you gotta look that one up, huh? I want to know which goldsmith said, let me take a look and see how I make this an accurate representation of what these look like. That's what I would like to know. And I wonder if when the Israelites got them, if they knew, well, looky there. That's a golden emerald. So, anyway. Does God have a sense of humor? I think so. You know, he plagues them in a terrible way. Eli... He's fat, he's old, he falls over backwards, breaks his neck, kills him. His grandson is born at that very moment, and as his mother dies, she names him Ichabod. Besides a fellow named Crane, that's the only person I know of that's ever been named Ichabod, and his name is really sad. It's kind of like Mara, you know, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. You know, it means bitter. Well, Ichabod means the glory has departed. And that is absolutely the truth. From that point in time on, the ark does not rest inside the tabernacle until the time of David. So, there's no way that they could have carried out the Day of Atonement during the entire time of Samuel's ministry. There's no way that they could have done that because there's no ark in there to, no mercy seat to sprinkle blood on. And that ark... where it resides with the Philistines until they get rid of it, and then it resides in a feller's house for years, for 20 years. The ark sits there during that period of time. As we go along, we see Samuel, he gets old. His sons are worthless as well. It's really sad. It's really sad. I mean, how many bad dads are there in Scripture? Guys, other than Job and God himself, it's really hard to find a good dad in Scripture. And I think it's this wonderful warning to us that as men, we have the great ability to just be deadbeats, you know? And even to start strong like David. David starts out like gangbusters. He's one of the worst dads that you can find. And Samuel, his kids are... But Samuel is able to experience revival in Israel during that period of time. He's the one who chooses Saul. Also, remember the people, this always confused me. I read this so carefully for years and years and years until I finally settled this in my head. God says, you're going to choose this king, and this is what he's going to do to you. But if you read very carefully, God chose the king for them. They did not vote on the king. Samuel didn't go pick the king. God said, here he comes. He shows Samuel these visions of how he's going to meet him and what's going to happen. And God basically says, you want a king? Here's your king. And then he told them exactly what that king was going to do. And I can't help, every time I read that, as you read about what God says there, I believe it's in chapter 8, verse 11. Let's just read that real quick. It's just a reminder. For you live in a very unique time in the history of the world. There's never, ever, ever been a group of people who've had the incredible privilege of the freedom that you and I, nobody ever, has experienced what you and I have experienced. George Washington, we're told, could have been made king and absolutely refused it. Didn't even want to serve as the president. They kind of had to beg him to do that. But really worked hard to put some things in place to make sure that he wasn't seen as a king. Verse 11 of chapter 8, he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. Some shall run before his chariots. We already talked about what God thinks of chariots, that they had to hoe all those chariot horses so the Israelites didn't have chariots. Well, he'll have chariots, and he'll take your sons. Watched Hacksaw Ridge and saw the draft take place during World War II. And looking back at some of my family and seeing every man in my family, my grandfather and every one of his brothers were drafted.
So that whole Saving Private Ryan deal, that happened all the time. My great-grandfather applied to the government, said a hardship deal, said, you can't take all of my boys, I don't have any help on the farm. So they let one of the boys come home as a result of him begging them. They didn't care. They needed fodder, cannon fodder, as much of it as they could possibly get. Well, that's what the king's going to do. He's gonna take your sons. He'll appoint them captains over thousands, captains over fifties. He'll set them to ear his ground, reap his harvest, make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he'll take your daughters to be confectionaries, to be cooks and to be bakers. And he'll take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. So, in other words, what he's saying, look, right now you're free. And you bring the tithe, and you bring the first fruits in, and you give that to God and to the Levites. And the rest of it's yours. But you get you a king, and not only are you going to have a tithe, but then you're going to have some taxes. And you're going to have a draft. And you're going to have to go fight the wars at the whim of the king. And he will take the tenth of your seed and your vineyards and give to his officers and his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And he will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And he shall cry out in that day because your king, which he shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. You want it. You got it, Toyota. I'm just telling you what you're going to get, is basically. And I think America should read that and then read the Constitution and say, why do we not have a king? Because a king, there's only one good king, and his name is Jesus. And other than that, a king is a tyrant, he's a despot, and there's really no way around it. So, verse 20, he tells him, he gives him, it's almost like, are you sure? Are you really, really sure this is what you want? You know? Nay, they say, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations. Oh, we want to be like Venezuela. Oh, we want to be like, who is that? Norway. Oh, Norway is just the greatest place in the whole wide world. But, no. They needed to be under the theocracy. God was their king. All they had to do was obey him, and they would be blessed. But they didn't want that. They didn't want to be this distinct and different people. They wanted to be like everybody else. And I think it's a great reminder. You are an American. You can do away with all that African-American and all that kind of stuff. That's a bunch of hogwash. You're an American. You don't have a king for a reason. And you should really, really pray and vote and fight to keep it that way. Because this is one of the most honest statements about what a king will do to a group of people that I think I've ever seen. And so, shouldn't surprise us though, because it's the word of God, right? So, Saul is chosen. By the way, also, isn't it interesting? He's head and shoulders taller than all the rest of them. And I find that real interesting whenever they're going to meet with Goliath, because basically Saul is the giant of the Israelites. And there is no way that he's going to go face the giant of the Philistines. And I find that really, really interesting. So Saul is going to become very presumptuous. He's going to try to assume the role of a priest. He's going to offer the sacrifices that Samuel is supposed to offer. He's going to disobey God and not eradicate the enemy like he's told. He's gonna be rejected by God, and then Samuel's going to anoint David as king. David's going to serve in Saul's court. Of course, he's going to defeat the giant. He's going to be an incredibly successful and violent military leader. David is a Navy SEAL, Green Beret, Airborne Ranger, meaner than a junkyard dog, and as a result of that, he's going to be that kind of king like some of our former presidents, that he's a military man who becomes a leader. And what that's going to do for David is that's going to give him the military and the mighty men that are the leaders of the military. They are going to surround David, and that's going to be a very important asset for David and his kingdom. Saul represents the flesh. David represents the spirit. If you just want to break that down as you begin to read more and more about David and through this and about Saul, it's a neat picture of the New Testament. Galatians chapter 5 says there's a war between the flesh and the spirit, and Saul is Saul is the man who's chosen to fulfill the role, but he will not listen to God. He he's very self-willed. He's very he's another one that he starts out great, but then he fades very, very quickly. And he's more of a political leader. He wants to take polls and see, you know, he wants to make sure that things are done the right way. And even his son recognizes that he's losing it. And Jonathan fulfills a really interesting role as a go-between between these two guys. So, once again, faith in God brings obedience and blessing, and failure to obey God brings judgment. We see that over and over and over and over and over again through that. So, by the way, we've got several contrasts in this. The first one, I think, is between Hannah and the other wife. I don't know how you say her name. Peninnah. Peninnah, she's just, you know, fertile myrtle, and she's just having kids, and Hannah's not. And the Bible's very clear that God had closed Hannah's womb, and so this was a part of God's plan for Hannah. We see godly Samuel versus Eli's wicked sons. So the sons of the flesh are wicked, but this adopted boy that's been given from Hannah is this godly little boy that's just surely sold out for the Lord. And then we see Saul versus David, and those contrasts in this book are pretty clear. So any thoughts about what we've read in 1 Samuel so far? I'm going to show you something kind of interesting. I find it interesting. Let's trace the ark and the tabernacle up to this point real quick. We kind of got to be careful that we don't lose sight of this, because as I said a minute ago, during the days of Samuel, strange things are going on, because the Philistines capture the ark, but the ark does not return to the tabernacle after they bring it back. The fact that she names that child Ichabod is true. The glory of God, God's seat, his mercy seat, does not reside in the ark during this period of time. So the ark starts out. It starts out at a place once they cross. In the book of Numbers, of course, the ark travels with the tabernacle all through the wilderness wanderings, and it's moved like 41 different times. But once you come into the land of Canaan, the ark is set up at a place called Gilgal. And that is kind of the base of operation. That's HQ for the beginning of the conquest at Gilgal. And then after a lot of the conquest has taken place, before they begin divvying up all the land, before they survey the land, they have to find another spot for the ark, and so for the tabernacle, so they move into a place called Shiloh. And Shiloh is where it stays for a long time. That's where they draw lots and divvy up the land, and that's where it is when we start reading 1 Samuel. Eli is ministering as the high priest at Shiloh. And what's interesting about Eli is Eli is not a descendant of Eleazar. He is a descendant of Ithamar. So you remember Aaron had four sons, right? Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord, and God killed them. Eleazar became the high priest. So it would stand that his son would have been the high priest. But for some reason, and we're not told why, Eli is serving as the high priest. And Eli, because he will not discipline his sons and put a stop to what they're doing, a curse is pronounced on Eli's lineage that will put a stop to his descendants serving as the high priest. Now, some more of his descendants will serve, but there's going to come a point in time where, during the days of Solomon, his son is going to be dismissed, and his family will never serve in that priestly line again. To fulfill that curse that, you remember, God tells Samuel, and Eli says, "Tell me what he said." Samuel's like, "I don't want to tell you what he said because he cursed you." "No, you tell me." It's all right. God said, "Because you've done this, this is what's going to happen to you." Right? So the tabernacle stays at Shiloh until something real interesting happens. Let's go to Psalm 78 right quick. And... Now let's read The whole psalm is wonderful. It's a great history of the people of Israel, and you should read the whole thing. But I want to begin reading in verse 9, and then we're going to skip around a little bit. So verse 9 says, the children of Ephraim, now that's where Shiloh is. Shiloh is situated in the land of Ephraim, okay? Now, who was Ephraim? Joseph's son. And you remember the whole, I mean, we got to go all the way back to Genesis. So Jacob's going to die. Joseph brings his sons. Right. Manasseh's the oldest. So he lines up Manasseh here, Ephraim here. Jacob does this now. Remember that? Well, since Joseph is the firstborn of Rachel, who was the wife that he was supposed to have. No, Joseph's not. Yeah. Yeah. And then so now out of those tribes, Ephraim, being the one who receives the blessing of the firstborn from Jacob, is going to be the one where the tabernacle resides. But because of the apostasy of the people, and because of what happens in that battle, and the fact that they take the ark and the bloodshed that happens, and then they come back and mop up Shiloh after that, the Philistines do, somehow Eli's descendants are able to survive, because we meet some of them later, and Samuel's able to survive. But because of that, Ichabod takes place. The glory of the Lord departs Shiloh, and the ark does not return there. The ark of the covenant. So the tabernacle remains there for a while. But it says there in verse 9, the children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. This is talking about that battle that day with the Philistines, when Eli's boys took the ark with them. They kept not the covenant of God and refused to walk in his law and forgot his works and his wonders that he had showed them. Marvelous things did he in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt and the field of Zoan. He goes on from here and he talks about what God did in Egypt. He divided the sea and he brought plagues and all that. So skip down with me down to verse 59. It says there, when God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, which he placed among men. So the tabernacle that was situated in Shiloh, God forsook it. His mercy seat, his ark, was taken out of there, and it was not returned to that spot. And it says in verse 61, he delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hands. That's exactly what happened. The Philistines took the ark. And he gave his people over also unto the sword, and was wroth with his inheritance. And the fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord awakened as one out of sleep, and like a mighty man that shouteth by reason of wine. And he smote his enemies in the hinder parts, and he put them to a perpetual reproach. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph, and chose not the tribe of Ephraim. So up until this point, God was going to allow that center of worship to reside in the land of Ephraim in Joseph's inheritance. But because of the apostasy of the people, he forsook them and he refused that. Verse 68, but chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like high palaces, like the earth which he hath established forever. He chose David also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob his people, and Israel his inheritance. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart, and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. And then if you'll turn over to the book of Jeremiah chapter 7, this is 500 years after the fact, Jeremiah prophesying about that. He says, Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 12. Jeremiah says there, Jeremiah 7, 12, but go ye now unto my place which was at Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because ye have done all these works, saith the Lord, and I spake unto you, rising up early and speaking, but ye heard not, and I called you, but ye answered not, therefore will I do it unto this house. Now he's pointing at Jerusalem. So Jeremiah prophesying at the time of the Babylonian captivity, and we're not there yet in our reading, but he basically says, I want you to remember what happened in Shiloh. Remember why the tabernacle doesn't sit at Shiloh anymore. Jeremiah pointed to that temple that Solomon had built, and he said, I'm going to do the same thing to that one. And he says, therefore I would do unto this house, which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh.
Wow.
So once again, Ichabod declared during the time of Jeremiah as the Babylonian captivity. The tabernacle survived and was re-erected at Gilgal during the days of Samuel. I'm thinking that after the death of Eli and his sons, that Samuel, they broke camp, they took that thing down and they hid it somewhere so the Philistines wouldn't get it too. And then eventually Samuel is going to set it up again back at the original spot where it all started. Once again, it's going to be set up at Gilgal. So Gilgal is the place where the sacrifices will be offered to make Saul king. And it is we see that in 1 Samuel chapter 10 that they do that at Gilgal. I believe we proved that to you. 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 8. And thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down unto thee to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry till I come to thee and show thee what thou shalt do. So Gilgal, once again, is the place where that's going to happen. It's going to remain at Gilgal until... And actually, you're going to have a point in time where you've actually got more than one tabernacle, because King David is going to pitch a tent for the ark in Jerusalem. He's going to bring the ark after several unsuccessful attempts to Jerusalem, but this one is still going to be there at the same time. So eventually, they're going to stop what's going on here. They're going to move those priests to Jerusalem, and then they're going to... Then there's going to be a tabernacle in Jerusalem, and then during the days of Solomon, then they'll go ahead and build the temple. Yeah?
During Moses' time, when he first consecrated the temple, and did the glory of the Lord fill the temple or the ark? And was the glory of God in the ark? But, I mean, I've always seen it as a place where God resided when they were moving it. And is that a misunderstanding of what the ark was?
Yeah. I think that the glory of God, whenever they did that, it filled the whole thing. I mean, it just the smoke, the cloud, the Shekinah glory just fills everything during the time of Moses. And God started the fire, too. They laid out the sacrifices, and he started the fire for them, and then they were supposed to perpetually keep that burning.
So the happens ark again. The Holy of Holy things, the covenant, and I mean, what was the ark purpose?
The ark is basically, it's basically God's throne on earth. It would be the way that I would describe that. The mercy seat is, you know, the picture is inside the ark is the broken law, the Ten Commandments, the Aaron's rod that had budded, proven that he was the high priest, and the jar of manna that they were told to keep with that. So all of that was in the Holy of Holies, associated with the ark, and supposed to be there. And then the lid for the ark is called the mercy seat, which is this great picture of God looking down through mercy at his broken law. And had it not been for the mercy seat, you know, they'd all been dead immediately, right? The most holy place is the place where... it's the place where God's presence on earth was situated. But as we come to the New Testament, you know, Stephen basically says, is there any way that we could build a house to contain God? So there's, you know, that was for the Levitical system. And yes, God did manifest himself in his glorious way there. But that stopped with the death of Eli. And it stopped again prior to the Babylonian captivity. And then after that, when they came back, I mean, during the days of Jesus, there's no ark. And nobody knows There's all kind of, that's a fun theory for you right there. So to start trying to figure out where the ark is today. Yes, sir.
So God did make himself, he did come to earth during the Old Testament times under other names, right?
Sure.
But people were allowed to be near him then, but not in the temple.
And every time that he did, that he appeared, that people could actually see him, he appeared as the angel of the Lord. And it was always a take your shoes off. This is a holy situation. So, yeah, good point. So, no man can see God and live, right? But yet, people see the angel of the Lord. Moses and the 70 elders saw the God of Israel. But yet, no man can see God and live. So the only way that I can understand that is to say that anytime anyone ever saw God, they were looking at Jesus. Now, sometimes it was pre-incarnate. And then, of course, during his incarnation, lots of people saw him. But God, like in the tabernacle situation, Aaron would be very careful and his sons to fill that room with smoke before they went in there. So they would burn incense to fill up that room with smoke so that they couldn't see anything when they went in to sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat. So you cannot look at the Father and live. But you can see God as he has portrayed himself to us in the person of Christ and live. So that's the only way I can explain that. So now they did see his glory, but it always manifested itself as smoke. No matter, this is I'm trying to think where I've read this. This may be some rabbinical hooey, but basically one of the miracles of the tabernacle, they say, was that no matter which direction the wind was blowing, the smoke always ascended straight up from the tabernacle, from the incense and from the altar that was burning, and that was one of the miracles that God performed. But the shadow by day and the fire by night, that also is God's manifestation of his glory that the Israelites benefited from. So yeah, the ark is one of those things that it's impossible to carry out the Day of Atonement without the ark. Because the priest has to go in, he has to sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat. So that was not happening during the time of Saul, during the time of David. Not until David brought that ark up, that Day of Atonement, you know. So when David reinstitutes the worship and establishes the priests in Jerusalem, that would have been a big deal for the Israelites because they really hadn't had atonement offered for the nation in years at that point in time.
Is there any evidence that God's glory existed prior to them losing the ark by taking it to battle? I mean, you see it in the Mosaic time, you see it in the but after they cross over and after they start doing what they're doing now, there's not much emphasis about God's presence. I mean, are we to assume that it was still there the same, or?
I think what you see is intermittent bits and pieces, but if you look in 1 Samuel, when God calls Samuel in chapter 3, it says there in verse 1, the child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. And so I think that basically that means the prophets weren't saying anything. There wasn't much going on. And then it goes on to say, it says, it came to pass that time when Eli was laid down in his place, his eyes began to wax dim that he could not see. And ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of God. See, that was to never, ever happen. That was to perpetually burn. So it shows you just how lax Eli was, how lax his sons were. So no, there wasn't a lot of the manifestation of God's presence. I think you see it in glimpses. You see it with Samson's strength. You see it with the battle that Deborah and Barak were involved with when they defeated Sisera. You're going to begin to see it more and more and more in the life of Samuel. You're going to see God answer prayer in mighty ways from there on. But as far as the tabernacle situation, no, you're not seeing much at all. Eli's let the fire go out. And really, the main times that you see that is at the dedication of the tabernacle in Moses' day. Then once again, you see it when Solomon dedicates the temple. It's the same way. It says the cloud was so thick the priests couldn't minister. Everybody just stopped. And it was a supernatural thing that took place. So yeah, it's kind of sad. They all just kind of they were going through the motions, but you know, it's like the old preacher used to say. Might say certain church over the door, but it's dead as a hammer inside. And I think that's what was going on. So, yeah.
Does the Bible specify what the ark was made out of?
Yeah, it was made out of acacia wood, and then it was overlaid with gold. A guy named Bezalel built it, and so it had a golden crown around the top, had two beaten cherubim on the top of the lid. So yeah, I mean it's very specific as to actually what it looked like. Two cubit high by 2 cubits long, and so it's basically 2 squares this way. Had feet on it. Set up off the ground, they carried it with staves. So yes, if you look in the book of Exodus, it'll give you a very detailed description of exactly what it looks like. So, some people think Jeremiah hid it. Some people think the Coptic church has it hidden in Egypt somewhere. According to Spielberg, it's in Area 51 in a warehouse. Right.
Where do you think it is?
I really don't know. I think it's in heaven. That's what I think. The book of Revelation tells us that there'll be a time after the second coming of Christ that the ark will be seen. And I think God came, got it, took it to heaven. I don't even think it's here. Because when Jesus died on that cross and God ripped that veil from the top to the bottom, he was done with that temple and everything that goes with it. And the only thing that's going to be restored to that at all, I think, is the spot. And I think there's going to be another temple built, which is going to be an Antichrist temple by apostate Jews that are just... He's going to go in there and declare himself to be God, and that's going to be the beginning of the really, really bad part of the Great Tribulation. And then I think that one's going to be torn down, and then I think there's going to be a bigger temple, bigger than we've ever seen and different than we've ever seen, built during the Millennial Kingdom. And possibly during that time, maybe, the ark will play some kind of a role once again. But basically, Jesus is the ark. He's the mercy seat. So I think God just completely took that out. It's like the body of Moses. You know, Satan wanted the body of Moses. I don't know what for. I'm thinking maybe to use that to come back as the Antichrist in, maybe, or something like that. And God hid it, and Michael debated with him about where it was, and that was it, you know. And I think the ark is much the same way. I think it would, you know, Indy just doesn't get to find it, you know. The Germans, they didn't get to use that as their powerful weapons. Anyway, good question. I don't know. So, all right. Well, I tell you what. Let me pray.